Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Hello, Rabbit.
Hey,
isn't the fall coming rushing in here?
It is, and here we are again. If it's Sunday morning or whatever time it is, then we're doing another program. We hope you're going to listen to it and have a wonderful time. And this will be the first installment of several programs coming from the result of a week-long trip that we just completed to the wonderful city of Portland, Oregon.
And boy, did we eat well.
We did. And we're going to try and introduce it in a sort of a disciplined fashion, unlike our usual undisciplined fashion of doing things. So our first interview is with Greg Higgins, who in many ways was an instigator of the dining scene in Portland as we now have it, coming from a sous chef position at the famous Heathman Hotel. About 15 years ago, Greg established his own place of business only about two blocks away and proceeded to start a movement, I think you probably would call it. And the best thing I think we can do is listen to the dialogue where Ann asked to explain that movement and what it's all about and what it's been like to run a restaurant for all that time.
On the Menu, off and on, has had this but frequently distant love affair with Greg Higgins. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you guys?
Okay. Greg's restaurant in Portland, Oregon, Higgins, and I'm not going to use that word I hate, eponymous or whatever it's called. I hate that. It's self-named. You're viewed really as a pioneer in this whole culinary scene in Portland. Now, you kind of demure, but weren't you?
Well, I came here early, and I guess I was the first fish in the pond, so to speak. So, and gradually the pond's grown up around me. So,
now, what has happened here? It was very hot for a while. Then it sort of went away, and now it's full-blown again.
Well, I could draw a parallel to the wine industry here. When I first came in the early 80s, there were 30 wineries. Now they're approaching 500. And the same kind of thing in the restaurant scene. There's been kind of a couple waves of proliferation. But for about 10 years through the 80s, it was kind of growing slowly and just, you know, very steadily. And then in the 90s, things really took off. And then it kind of ebbed a little bit and then started back up again. In the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, it's really exploded again. But I think it's sort of the same thing in the wineries, that there's another generation, or maybe even you could say almost two generations of new chefs and restaurateurs that have made the scene here. And some of them, you know, in the wine industry, it was a lot of the children or the people who were assistant winemakers went on to form their own wineries. And I think the restaurant scene is the same. A lot of our sous chefs have moved on and opened their own places. So there's a great selection of ingredients to work with here, tremendous seasonality, really, really wonderful, sustainable local agriculture.
Draw, isn't it?
And now that's become natural. It's everybody sees it as the way you do business, is you buy from your local sources and you focus on those ingredients and their integrity.
Now, you hail from Buffalo, New York.
Yes.
Via Seattle.
The frozen tundra of Buffalo.
And you said that you were actually a printmaker, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm schooled in fine arts and came to cooking from another direction. But I worked as a cheesemaker and a sausage maker in high school, so I sort of had a taste for food, so to speak.
You were sort of bred for this, if you were doing that in high school. Right?
Yeah, I was always a hungry kid, and this was the best solution was to learn how to cook.
And there weren't many people in high school at that time making sausage.
No, right? True.
Amazing. But you were saying also you're getting a lot of recruits to this area. It's a nice lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Talent from East and West Coast. Hmm?
It's a super livable city. Cost of living here is very reasonable, all things considered. And there's just a buzz around. I just came back from Chicago, and everyone was saying, gee, I'm really thinking about moving out there. And
really?
Yeah.
From
so,
Chicago.
And in the culinary scene there. We're also teaching at Kendall College there, so I was exposed to a lot of youngsters that are just coming up through the ranks.
I'd love if you would just mention that program a little bit about your children's program.
Which program now?
The program we were in Chicago talking about.
We're doing a thing for the Chefs Collaborative there. And two things. One, we did a green market benefit, and then the second thing was a two-day Chefs Collaborative Summit. So there are about 200 chefs and affiliated food people there for that event.
No, I'm talking about the thing with the kids.
For Zenger Farms?
Yes.
Oh, that's here in Portland. Oh. That's an urban farm
that's
here.
That's on your T-shirt.
It's on the T-shirt, Zenger exactly. An urban farm that's been turned totally sustainable. It's within the city limits of Portland. They reclaim their own water, generate most of their own power, raise just a full level of different seasonal crops of vegetables as well as chickens. And the kids go there and take summer camps as well as field trips throughout the year and learn how to grow and harvest food, how to compost, how to do all those things necessary to running a small-scale market garden farm. And then the profits from the sale of the food for CSAs and for public markets goes back into subsidizing the farm's operation.
This is the future, and we have it here.
Hold on, there's a special event we forgot to mention, which takes Greg away from the kitchen this evening, which is a movie that's actually going to benefit this same organization, I think you said.
Yeah, we've got a film we've been working on for 2 years, and tonight it premieres called Ingredients. And Ingredients is an example, a proactive look at how a food system operates like this, how the different elements interplay with one another, restaurants, farmers markets, CSAs, backyard gardens, a little bit of everything. And it's an attempt to try and teach people how they can engage in their local setting and help develop a more vibrant food scene so that local agriculture flourishes and people are eating more healthy, fresh local food.
And let's
God bless,
The film's called Ingredients. It's a documentary.
Ingredients. It'll be out on public television sometime in the next year. I can't say when.
And it's also going into general distribution if you can get it.
Yeah, hopefully Netflix will have it. So.
There we go. Great. So it'll be something a little different than the things you watch on Netflix, and it'll be a whole lot better for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's focus a little bit back on, you can't have been in business this many years. How many years is it again?
Higgins is 15 years now, going on 16.
Okay,
yeah.
You have to be doing something right to stay in business.
Well,
we think
it's a pretty secret formula, which is called making people happy.
Uh-huh.
So we try and have an unintimidating style of service, food preparation, and just hospitality, make people really feel
comfortable. Yeah, you were always accessible. We had here probably 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. You were just new.
Just getting rolling. Yeah,
and you wouldn't have known us from a cake of soap, and you were so nice. It was great.
Well, I think it's a general thing that we want people to come in and not feel intimidated. They may be unfamiliar with some of the concepts on the menu or some of the ingredients, but we never want them to feel out of place or afraid to ask or, somehow help them learn a little bit about who they're about to enjoy.
Well, you're the kind of chef. I would never ask you what your style of cooking is because, first of all, I already know. But secondly, it's exactly the question you would not want to have asked.
We call it home cooking.
Yeah, all right. But what are some of your specialties? You change your menu all the time, but what can
well,
be
yeah, the menu
when they
rotates.
Come here?
What I always tell them is that we think of it in terms of providing a little bit for everybody. So a third of the menu is seafood, all fresh, local, sustainable products. A third is vegetarian. Part of that, half of that's vegan for those who don't eat animal products of any sort. And then the other half is meat. And all the components are we buy from 40 or more small local farms. So they're really tasting what the farmers are doing in this particular area at this particular time.
But you're not endlessly listing every single
supplier
in your menu.
We think of it as a relationship with our customers, mm-hmm. and that they come to know sort of our style of cooking, which is, I guess you would call it kind of French country or a little bit of Western European, a little Italian influence here and there and whatnot. But the idea is that they know that we're picking out the best ingredients we can find from the very proudest farmers who are raising those things that are really into what they're doing. And it's going to taste great on the plate, and we're going to try and make sure that we don't lose the integrity of that product getting it there. So
we talked to one chef in London, of all places. We said, how do you get new ingredients? You always seem to have something new on the menu. How do you do that? And he said, I sort of, people know we're here, so they bring us things. Does the same thing happen to you?
Well, we have a little joke in the kitchen. They say that I'm a freak magnet, that all the crazy people in the world are growing obscure things like medlars or whatnot will show up. And
I know what medlars are, actually.
Well, try and make something good with a medlar.
What are they called in Italy? The fruit of the medlar tree. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the thing that looks like it is rotten.
It's a thorny little thing, yeah. You have to
brown spots on it and everything.
They basically have to be about rotten before you can do anything with
yes.
them.
Yes. I think they just sell them in stalls. I don't know. But, okay, so you get all these weird things.
So we do, but and I think that's absolutely true, though. I'm a gardener. I have a year-round garden at my home, and I experiment. I gather seeds when I travel, and I plant those. And those, to me, the inspiration for good cooking comes out of the garden. So if I can inspire the gardeners, the farmers, as well as my cooks with those ingredients, then that's the way we try and approach it. So,
do you know David Kinch down at Manresa?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's got a
super operation. Mm-hmm. Slightly bigger garden than your
sure.
own garden.
That garden is
but he's, yeah, phenomenal.
He's doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
it's I want that ice lettuce, whatever
yeah.
it's called.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, ice plant. Yeah.
We had the first in England, and you can't get it. I mean, it just mm-hmm. it wouldn't grow in Pennsylvania.
Traveling's a great thing because, I mean, maybe I shouldn't be telling anybody this, but I love to bring back seeds, and I love to take seeds with
yeah,
me when I go.
Yeah, I mentioned,
so.
I was about to suggest that you shouldn't say that again.
USDA guys, turn your program down.
Now, what do you think? This is hard, but there's a common thread running through the Portland restaurants with fresh, sustainable, honest ingredients. There has to be one thing that makes you stand out because you have stood out for 15 years. What is
well,
it?
Well, I'd say that part of it is it's sort of the raging bull deal. We've been standing so long that we're at the top of everybody's list, and that includes the farmers. So we kind of get the pick
first.
Of the litter. They call us first, and so that ensures that really, really get superb stuff to work with. The other part of it is just to be excited about cooking. And I still come in every day and cook all day long, and I'm trying to teach and inspire the staff to really respect
and love what
they're doing.
You don't have a TV show or anything?
No, I don't have a TV show. I don't have a book. Don't have I got a little bit of a movie role starting tonight.
But okay.
That's small stuff. I mean, what we try and do is be inspired about the bounty of ingredients here and then hope that translates into really enjoyable food on the plate. And I think it does. I don't think if you're not really respectful and excited about what you're doing and what you're cooking with, then I don't think the food can come out that well. So I really think that keeping that energy level up is a key thing to making great food.
What are we going to eat tonight?
Yeah, we were on the same page. Why don't we real time?
Well, that's now. This is a tough time.
What I would suggest
tonight is let's start about the seasonality. Right now, it's the crossover between the late summer and the fall harvest. So we've got just incredible chilies, amazing tomatoes. The corn is phenomenal right now. The wild mushrooms, the best chanterelles of the year, are coming in, as are some lobster mushrooms.
Oh, I'll have some of those, yeah.
So I'd suggest perhaps some fresh Oregon or Alaskan halibut on a succotash with that sweet corn and those chilies. And there's lobster mushrooms in the succotash. That's quite delicious. We make you really should have tomatoes because they're only going to be – these heirlooms will only be here for another few weeks, 2-3 weeks. And then we make a fresh ricotta cheese to go with those. So you should try that combination because it's just the perfect balance of the two. So those are two key things to look forward to.
Can we get some idea of where we are in terms of Portland?
Okay, try it again. So we're located here in the Cultural District in Southwest Portland, pretty much the heart of downtown, block from the museums, Performing Arts Center right on Broadway.
And we're going to give us how to reach it. I mean, a website probably is the best way.
Oh, sure. We're easy to find. We're on City Search, so just go to higgins.citysearch.com.
Okay.
And you'll locate our little webpage there.
And the one thing that I can't really close this interview without bringing up is you started at one phase of your life as a sausage maker a long time ago. And so this restaurant is not surprisingly known for its charcuterie. Tell us about that.
Well, if there's any one item, most things do, but I think especially pork really embodies the flavor of a place. So our pigs are raised at a small farm outside of town here. And then
What kind are they?
They're Berkshire Duroc crosses. So they're not a pure heritage breed. They're a cross between two heritage breeds. And every Wednesday we butcher pig and turn it into all kinds of tasty little bits.
Oh,
and
you butcher too, don't you?
We do, yes. And
now, but you yourself.
Yeah, I am the butcher.
Butchering.
Yes. Yeah. That would
How did
be
you
me.
Learn that?
Well, if you want to make sausage, you got to start with a pig. So.
Oh,
so at any rate, yeah, we got a whole bunch of that, and it's woven throughout the menu. It appears in soups. It appears in our whole pig plate. It appears in our charcuterie plate, which is a selection of 8 or 10 or 12 different little cured and smoked items that celebrate the tremendous flavor of those naturally raised pigs.
Well, I can hardly wait to tell you the truth. And so let's begin.
Great. Yeah.
Let the good times roll.
Okay.
How do you say that in Buffaloese?
Buffaloese. Let's have a beer.
So there you have it. How Portland's modern dining scene got its start, I guess you might say.
And then who's the person on everybody's lips when they talk about hot restaurants in Portland today?
Now, because we're transitioning from you can't call it a model standbys, I guess, after 15 years, but certainly people who have a mature restaurant business. But now there's a whole set of what might call young guns. who are wowing diners in Portland, and the wowest of the wow is I think he would agree if we described him as crazy Gabriel Rucker.
He's wonderful.
Of La Pigeon, and if you don't believe he's crazy, wait till you hear this interview.
Our guest here said, okay, let's talk and drink vodka. So we're going to try and do both of them at the same time. And we're talking with Gabriel, not Gabe, Rucker.
Gabriel
Rucker.
Rucker.
Who has a restaurant called Le Pigeon or Le Pigeon. Or
Le Pigeon, or whatever you call it. The Pigeon, whatever.
And we sampled.
In Portland, right in Portland.
Yeah, we sampled a snack of his food last Thursday night in an event which will be coming up in the program very soon. But we caught up with him for a more in-depth interview at this Wild Game event, where he just won. Well, do we want to record what place he placed? He was first, second, or third, and we won't tell you which.
No, he said this is the first time he actually placed third, and his restaurant is probably one of the top restaurants in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, well, you can take. I already
I have no shame in placing third place. I'm happy. This is just an event with all of our friends, and we just have a good time. It's lighthearted. So
not only that, there were 10 of the top chefs in the area competing.
Yeah,
and it was you grabbed. It's a mystery box thing, and your mystery box included what?
It was buffalo, so it had the buffalo heart, the buffalo liver. And maybe the tenderloin, I just used the heart and the liver.
Which is not exactly the easiest thing to cook. I think first place really went to a elk loin.
First place went to rabbit.
Oh, rabbit, yeah, I love rabbit. But anyhow, you got some oddball items and you managed to pull it off.
Yeah, I had fun. Took the idea of liver and onions.
Great, okay.
So what I did is I made a buffalo heart and caramelized onion pierogi. With some celery root in it.
What do you know about pierogies?
Only that my Polish friends cook it for me on Easter. Other than that, not much. Okay. But I winged it.
Yeah, because from Western Pennsylvania, we know for pierogies.
If you're a restaurant called Le Pigeon, I guess you wing it all the time.
That's right. That's right. Well, I didn't get squabs, so they would call me the ringer if I won that one. But so I decided the beautiful buffalo liver to play.
And finish the description of the dish because I interrupted you.
The dish was the pierogi with the heart and the onions and celery root, and then we had a nice piece of seared buffalo liver next to it, and then on top we had a little pickled fig, fresh fig. And raw buffalo heart salad. And then the sauce was a brown butter chestnut sauce.
See, my only complaint about this event, because we've been having a really wonderful time, is that we don't get to taste any of those things that you competed for.
Well, you know what? That's your complaint. That's not mine. I had to cook it. So,
but we did get to look at them, and I've never seen so many beautiful presentations. They were really pretty.
Yeah, you guys are from Pittsburgh, right? So the Northwest has some really great food going on, and it's really just fun to do this every year because it's all of my colleagues and peers and people. So everyone just kind of has a lighthearted attitude towards it, and we're all just joking around with each other, drinking beers, cooking food,
and
it's you know, we're cooking on our day off, but we're drinking beer and having a good time and just ribbing each other and having a good time, and no one really gets too serious about it.
And I already tweeted that I think it's one of the most fun chef communities I've been around. I love it.
Yeah.
Now, should we fast backwards or forwards to Le Pigeon in southeast Portland?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the restaurant...
Gabriel, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. The restaurant is about 3.5 years old, which makes me feel good. It feels like it's only been like 6 months, but it kind of came out of... a restaurant I was working at closing. Someone put me in touch with someone else who owned the restaurant and spot where I'm at. The chef was leaving, and I just kind of walked into a kind of a restaurant that was already built. And
it was called the same?
It was called Colleen's. And it was only around for like 6 months. And then I walked into a beautiful spot with a copper hood and a great little counter around the kitchen. And I just decided to cook food that I felt like would fit in the restaurant rather than walk in and say, I want to cook the food that I want to cook. I just kind of tried to cook food that fit the space. And then that turned into the food that I really want to cook myself.
Why is it? I mean, because we've eaten at so many really wonderful, wonderful restaurants in Portland and the surrounds. And they're all, each one of them has pristine ingredients and access to farmers and all the good buzz stuff going. Why is it the first restaurant everybody says, did you go, when they know I'm in Portland, did you go to Le Pigeon?
Well, I'd have to say that's because I've gotten lucky. We put a lot of work into what we do, and we love what we do, but I couldn't say why. Everyone here is my peer, and I respect what everyone does so much, and I think we're all kind of on the level, and I think I've just gotten lucky. I couldn't explain it. I mean, we...
See, because we haven't eaten there, so I have to admit that.
Yeah.
We've tasted food that you've prepared for events, but not actually had the restaurant experience. So I wondered what was so... what set you apart from all the other restaurants?
I don't think that anything sets us apart. I think that we've kind of we've gotten a little bit, you know, like I said, I think that there's so many places in town that do equal, if not better, food than we do. And we've just
kind
of...
You're very modest. I mean, you didn't seem like you were modest when I first met you, but you are modest.
Well, I think that the best way to embrace success is to not glorify it, you know, to just take it in stride and count your blessings every day. Every time you wake up from your pillow and you get in the shower before you go to work, say, thank you for knowing that people are going to come to my restaurant tonight, having fun. I think one of the reasons that we have become popular is my restaurant is about as small as this room that I'm interviewing in.
How many seats?
35.
Oh, that's great.
And the kitchen, I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, it's maybe a little bit bigger, but if you can imagine the kitchen being in this room, and then imagine coming to a dinner where you're going to get really great food, great sourced food, and having three chefs cook it for you. It's like being at a dinner party, an active dinner party.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's 10 of the 35 seats are a counter that goes right around the kitchen. And so that means that a third of my seats, people are just sitting there talking with me. I'm giving them spoon. While I'm tasting food, I'm giving them tastes. So it's a really interactive thing, and food is so...
Oh, shoot. Food, I'm so sorry I missed
this. Yeah, food is so big these days, and chefs are so kind of like this rock star thing with chefs. And so to be able to have people to be able to come in and sit down at the counter and watch what we do while we do it, and then people always say, oh, do you mind if I ask you a question? And it's like, ask me as many questions as you want. We have no secrets. And so it's kind of like a constant cooking show or something. You know, we just have fun making
food.
Why
did you call it the Pigeon?
Because I had a tattoo on my arm that said Le Pigeon.
Well, you have some really interesting tattoos. There's one which looks like a sardine can or anchovies.
It is. It's a can of anchovies. That was from a dinner I did. Actually, the first date I went on with my wife. I just got married to.
You just got married. She's
3 weeks
sweet.
Ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just met her.
And we...
Three weeks ago. Okay.
Yeah, we're newlyweds.
Okay,
so well, good luck.
Thanks.
But your tattoos are black and white.
Most of them, yeah. But I did a Portland chef and tattoo artist potluck dinner, and so we had eight tattoo artists and eight chefs, and my tattoo artist and I kind of got this together, and we did. So eight chefs came up with a dish, and then the tattoo artists, we got paired up with tattoo artists, and they tattooed us in the theme of our dish. So I made pork pickled sardines in a salad. And so I got a can of deviled ham right here on my wrist, and a can of sardines right here.
You've got to be making this
up. Nope, not at all. Not at all.
No, this has to be a first. Why wasn't this in the
It was in Portland. They put it in the Portland Monthly magazine.
It should be in New York Magazine, if not in the New York Times.
And I got married because of it, so... I got great tattoos. I got married and had to go to dinner.
She was a tattoo artist.
No, she was just along for the ride. And
I don't know where we go quite from there.
She finally decided she should take you in hand.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay. No, I mean
you look a little blown away.
No, I'm so sorry I missed that party.
You're going to start giggling soon, like the guests we had to giggle all the time.
No, I'm not. But I just think it sounds like so much fun. It makes me want to.
It was. And that's what happened. That's what happens here. I mean, we're all friends. You know? But a lot of people, like a lot of chefs that I know come from other cities, and they go, well, it's so funny. Like everyone in all the chefs in Portland are friends. Like, you know, it's so competitive in other cities. And we all root for each other, and we all send people to our friends' restaurants.
No, I mean, this is good. I've been in other communities that are close like this, and it really happens with a younger chef community. When you have, like, the established stalwart chefs in major markets, it gets a little different. Like, there's a lot of stuff goes on in San Francisco that's not at all like this. Same in New York, same in D.C., same in all those.
Well, Portland's getting itself put on the map. And
also Portland, Maine. What do you think about that?
I love it. I've done two Portland to Portland dinners with Steve Corey from 555 in Portland, Maine. He came out and we did the classic wine auction and we did a Portland to Portland dinner. And then we both, the same in 2007, were best new chefs for food and wine. And so I flew out to Portland, Maine and cooked a dinner with him at his restaurant. And so Portland, Maine's a really cool town.
I just want to ask you, for our listeners' benefit, if they come here, what to expect, what kinds of things to expect or special dishes to expect on the Pigeon's menu?
Oh, on the Pigeon's menu? Well, I can't really say because we change it all the time. I would definitely say that you want to save room for dessert because I think that everyone should have the foie gras profiteroles.
Oh, now that is fabulous. Tell me about that.
It's a dish. We have two desserts that are kind of mainstay or signature desserts that involve meat. We're a meat-heavy restaurant. So we have one that kind of has been won us national acclaim, which is a honey bacon apricot cornbread with maple ice cream and warm bacon bits and maple syrup. And then my personal favorite is our foie gras profiteroles, which people will come in just to eat. And it's profiteroles, which is a pot of choux, like a cream puff, pot of choux. And we make everything on this dish with foie gras except for the shaved chocolate and the sea salt. So we make our pot de choux profiteroles with foie gras butter. We make our caramel sauce with foie gras butter. We make foie gras ice cream with white port. And then we put foie gras powdered sugar over the top of it. And then you get a little shaved Scharfenberger chocolate and some Maldon sea salt on top. And I have a money-back guarantee on it because sometimes people don't know. And so they're sitting at the counter and they say, what should I have for dessert? And I say, you should have the foie gras profiteroles. And they look at me kind of with a cockeyed look. And I say, I have a money-back guarantee on this one. If you can look me in the eye and say you didn't like it, then I'll give you your money back. And only one person has ever given me their money back because they were a vegetarian. They didn't know what foie gras was.
Well, you know, to tell you, it sounds so good. I may actually add another night to our itinerary just to come and have this for dessert.
I don't quite know how we're going to do that.
I think you should.
Maybe we'll come
over for a foie gras profiterole after dinner tomorrow night.
Oh, dear. You've been a delight to talk to.
Thank you so much.
I'm so glad to have met you. And keep up the good work. And I don't even want to ask what's next because I want to be surprised.
All right. Well, you guys need to make it in for dinner sometime. It was a pleasure to meet you guys.
And you too. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I must say we had so much fun with him. I miss him, actually, after spending so much time with him. But I guess it's now time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Ann and Peter Haig were really delighted in Portland, Oregon, to discover an absolutely superb, would you believe, Peruvian restaurant. That's the case.
Well, we decided to move on, if you like, from the beginning of the story to the end of the story about Portland to look at Portland's ethnic dining scene, and certainly absolutely at the lead of that is Mama Doris of a wonderful restaurant called
Rodriguez
from a restaurant called Andina, named in honor of the Andes, as you'll find out more about as we listen to what she
nice
has to say.
It's a nice story too. She met her husband partner when he was in the Peace Corps in Peru, and she was teaching, and she's Peruvian, of course. Well, let's listen to the Doris Rodriguez de Platt. Did I say that well, Doris?
Yes, perfectly well. Thank you.
Thank you for having us at your restaurant, Andina. Cuisine here is Peruvian. You were born in Peru. In what city were you born?
I was born in a beautiful Andean city from the northern part of Peru, and its name is Cajamarca. Very old and ancient culture before the Incas took place in that area.
Pre-Incas,
they were called the Caxamarcas, with a beautiful ceramic and beautiful style of life. Then the Incas incorporated the Caxamarcas to their empire, and in 1532, the conquistadores arrived from Spain, arrived to, as a matter of fact, to my town, because the Inca, the last Inca, Atahualpa, was just taking thermal medicinal waters that come that are in my close to my town.
See.
It's called, right now we are called Baños del Inca. It has lots of sulfur, probably volcanic, and is very well used and appreciated for all the people.
Oh, well, so, I'm going to look forward to that.
So
I
you,
guess
if you go to Peru, yeah. I'd really like for you to go to Cajamarca now and visit it.
Well, we're going to take all of your suggestions because I'm very excited about that. And I'm excited about sampling your restaurant. Here we are in the middle of Portland, Oregon, in an up-and-coming region called the Pearl District, is it?
Yes, yeah.
And here you are. It is so authentic. The smells on entering your restaurant were just glorious.
Thank you.
Now tell me about, let's start with, what aspect? Do you do regional? Do you do traditional? Do you do modern? And your menus. Tell us what kind of food you feature.
Yeah, we are very proud of our menu and consistently with our mission, which is bringing a little bit of Peru to this area. We try to feature in our menu the two main trends of our Peruvian cuisine. One is the traditional, which we are very proud to have it from ancient times, and modern cuisine.
Now, why is it that apparently, as I've heard, modern cuisine has caught on among Peruvian chefs? Why is that?
Yeah, that's my own hypothesis.
Okay.
I hope it's true. What it happened is for centuries, we were a country influenced by different cultures, starting with the Incas, the Spaniards, and in the late 1920s, 20s came China in emigration, and Japanese and Italians.
And Portugal, too.
And Portuguese people, too, and some Jewish influence, too.
Yes.
So all of them made our food wonderful. But all of these influences were kept in the way that the food was made and generally was kept as a secret in hands of moms. We learned from generations before how we make certain things, and mom cooked with lots of love, lots of ingredients, incorporating from the garlic of the Spain that brought, and the cinnamon from the Far Eastern through Spain, plus the quinoa from our Incas. And then we incorporated a little bit of ginger and soy sauce.
Really?
Because of the Chinese influence. So all of these were, little by little, mixed in a wonderful way that we prepare food.
I'm really getting excited about this trip.
It
because
is.
It's, I think that I've heard that experts say that Peruvian cuisine will be the next big thing.
Yeah.
You agree?
And you know what happened? Yes, and I'm very proud. I think Peru is waking up.
Uh-huh.
And there is, we give credits to the young generation of Peruvian cooks who happen to be children of high medium class, became educated and growing with the flavors of mom's cuisine, and seeing, because they were able to travel, how the quality of food around the world is, and seeing how our Peru has as a country, they decided in a movement that was centered in Lima to rescue all of our crops that were almost forgotten in the Andes. And that's why we generated a modern cuisine called Novo Andina, because they rescued the food from the Andes, and especially some of them so old as the Incas, and gave with a flavor of mom that is based in peppers, garlic, and onion, they, with better skills, with better techniques, they elevate that food to a range or level of fine dining.
This is exciting.
And
stuff.
And besides that, they also were able to incorporate elements that moms or old generations couldn't think about it, like mixing tropical fruits in our main dishes, moms and grandmas could be terrorized. They said, what's happened here? But our new Novo Andina cuisine allows these chefs that they already have the flavor of the food in their mouth since they were small, and then they enrich the flavor with their creativity and they made a beautiful food, make it with good presentation and wonderful flavor.
I think it's about to burst on the earth.
It is, and now, I'm very proud.
But tell us I know we have a great deal of diversity in Peruvian cuisine, but could you tell us a little bit about some of the key ingredients? If I were to go there, and I am going there, what dishes or what ingredients, rather, should I be looking for?
Yeah, I will tell you. Probably it depends in the region where you are. I highly recommend if you are in the coastal area, ask most of the times for a fish or seafood dish. They become fresh and good quality. In the Andes, as I told you, probably we will go, if you go to visit the Andes, go for a stew, a soup. We have wonderful soups and wonderful stews. In my region, ask for seco de cordero. And we have in the menu now, if you try to have a preview,
it's lamb?
Made with lamb, rice and beans, with all the flavors that we have in Peru, which are base. And that's why I wanted to talk with you, because the basic flavor that unifies coastal food and Andean food and probably the jungle food is what we call the sofrito.
Sofrito.
The base is garlic, onions, and peppers that gradually we fried in a good oil till they practically become caramelized. And once you have the exact point of the caramelization, you can add any other ingredient you have in mind, especially herbs. We use a lot in the Andes.
What herbs? What kind of herbs?
Usually we have three main. One is called huacatay that I learned here. Some people know this herb that is not so popular here. It's called black mint.
Black mint. Yeah, I don't know that.
It is flavors the most amazing sauces and soups and stews, especially in Arequipa, the southern part of Peru, where I hope you can go. You need to taste ocopa la arequipeña, a beautiful dish made with this herb, plus peanuts and yellow peppers.
Okay.
So that's another herb that we use is cilantro. In Peru, we call culantro. And I learned that there are two varieties. The one is the source is the Andes. The leaves are a little bigger. We call culantro. And the ones that the Spaniards brought, it's called cilantro. But the same flavor. And another we have is a beautiful soup we make with paico that people in other regions in Mexico, they call epazote.
Oh, I know epazote. Yeah. Yeah.
In Peru, we have the fresh herb made in a beautiful soup that also moms love to make to the children with potato and fresh cheese.
Well, it's supposed to be to prevent gases. That's right.
And also all children who play in the ground, they become with parasites.
Parasites, okay.
And this soup is not only delicious, but it's very good. It makes the parasites die. So that's a wonderful soup.
I'm gonna have to have some of that.
So that's one of those herbs. We also have lemongrass, but we always use as tea. And we call it hierba luisa. It's so good with a pastry made with fresh corn, we call humitas. If someday you go to Cajamarca, ask for té de hierba luisa, it's lemongrass tea, and humita, which is a pastry made with fresh corn. It's a wonderful combination.
The terrain is very different top to bottom, isn't it?
Yes. That's why our restaurant is proud to be called Andina, because we want for the people to know how the Andes mean for us. Create microclimates that generate in different climates, different food, and practically Peru survives with the food that the Andes produce, and plus the seafood of the coastal area. I think it's true what many people say, that Peru is a poor country where everybody eats like rich people.
That's great. I mean, up to this point, I just thought of it as endless varieties of potatoes.
Oh, my gosh.
You do have good potatoes.
We have, and that's our pride, too. And I learned, we domesticated some close to 1,000 varieties.
Wow.
But wild, there are many thousands of varieties of these beautiful blue flower, white flowers, the small plants we call potatoes. And what is most amazing is not only the shapes of the potatoes, but also the colors and the textures and the flavors. So we love to have papa a la huancaína, a typical traditional dish, only with yellow potatoes, because the grain, the texture is excellent for the sauce basing our peppers and our cheese. So, and for any different dish, we have different variety of potatoes. And we are very proud that Ireland, all the Scandinavian are.
Doris, what we just ate, the flavors are just so deliciously complex, aromatic. Just explain a little bit about the details of what we just ate.
We gave you a little samples of two dishes that are very dear to us. One is called ceviche, and there are lots of ceviches made in whole Latin America, but of course we as Peruvians, we say that ceviche in Peru is the best in the whole world.
Well, this was delicious.
And we are very proud. What you have now, it's what we call the most classic ceviche, which is very simple. You have the requirement to have a good ceviche is a fish that is fresh and doesn't smell fishy. If you have that, the rest is just complement of the first requirement. What you ate was just fresh squeezed lime juice. I emphasize fresh squeezed because if you have a lime juice that lasts for more than 6 or 7 hours, there is not any more fresh, and that doesn't give you the quality of ceviche. You need to have it just for the morning and just for the afternoon. We prepare this fresh squeezed lime juice, and you add to the fresh fish, salt, onions that they need to be crisp and fresh, and we keep in ice cubes to bring it to bring always the freshness. And so we have fresh fish, salt, lemon juice, peppers, and onions. We call a ceviche of five elements, and is the most classic ceviche. We have more ceviches, and that's up to what our chefs can generate. If you put passion fruit and shrimps and green mango, you have a wonderful ceviche that people love.
I'm getting just so excited about this cuisine.
So ask for a ceviche de mango verde or ceviche clásico, and you will be delighted.
And this was the classic.
The classic ceviche,
Now, what about the empanada?
The empanada probably was brought by the Spaniards, and maybe they were influenced by the Moorish dominance they had in their southern part of Spain. The thing is, it's our pastry made not with ground beef. What we do is cut in small pieces the beef, and that's our pride. We don't use ground beef. Too
but
much
it's minced.
Fat. Yes.
Minced.
And once we do that, as we were taught by generations, by many generations before, we make a sofrito again with garlic, onions, peppers. We put a little cilantro leaves. We put the meat and a little cumin seed too.
Oh, that was that flavor.
The cumin. But not too much, because we are very careful not to over.
Yeah, this is very subtle, and yet it's
very
deep and complex.
And we have also mixed with hard-boiled eggs, cut it in small port sizes, and also it is probably Spaniard influence olives, but the olives that have pits. So we take the seed away, we cut it fresh, we import them. We call aceitunas de botija. It's one of the ingredients that we import from Peru. They come in water, and they are wonderful. And the olive trees all Peru were brought by the Spaniards, and we are very proud of that. So the combination of this meat and the spices and having care to mix all the flavors, we put in a pastry.
Yeah,
and
tell
we
me about the pastry. It's a very different pastry from the usual empanada pastry.
Yeah, we try to, our chef is giving the formula to get a dough that is smooth, as he says, as silky. And
it's
light, very light. We put it inside, and we have two alternatives. But in our restaurant, to be honest, we can have a baked empanada or deep-fried empanada. But because we want for the client to perceive the empanada coming warm and recently done, we prefer the deep-fried empanada. Uh-huh. It's a quick cooked. And we always spread a little powdered sugar. That brings what we learned as part of the whole experience. After a salty stuffing, a little bit of sweet gives a good complement. And also an edge of lemon. You need to have lemon juice inside of the stuffing. Enhances the flavor.
But you said to squeeze the lime.
Yeah, yes, squeeze. Put drops of this lime, fresh lime, into the stuffing, and the empanada is. You are in heaven trying to eat the whole thing. So we are very pleased. And
could you explain this drink?
The drink we have in our menu, one of the typical drinks, and we are very proud of it, is called chicha morada. We import the purple corn, Peruvian purple corn, that's a little different from the Indian corn you have in the United States. The purple corn in Peru is almost black. It's very dark, and we import periodically, and we make chicha morada in the restaurant as we make at home. In a big pot, you boil the corn, you put the spices there, not too much cinnamon, a little cloves, a whole pineapple with peel and pulp, green apple, quince, and we boil together till we extract the beautiful purple pigment from the purple corn to the liquid. And once it is, the liquid is strained, the whole thing. Put it a little bit of sugar, not too sweet. In Peru, we don't have too much sweet drinks. Except
yeah, it's not
our
sweet because I'm very sensitive to that. It's very refreshing.
And lime juice. If you see, most of our food, thanks to the Spaniards, that they brought us citrus from, and they also were lucky to have those from the Arabic. And for us, really, is one of the basic elements of our flavors.
And you can trust Doris on this because she's trained as a pharmacist, but she knows her ingredients.
Yeah.
And it's very high in antioxidants.
Sometimes,
and I loved also the tea.
You're right, yeah.
The tea was delicious.
There's another little tradition we try to keep in the restaurant is we always suggest the people after a good meal to end it up with a digestive tea. We call tea when we make infusion of herbs.
Fusion.
Most of them we grow in Peru wild, like chamomile and lemongrass or mint. But here we are so lucky that a small factory of tea made for us a special blend of different herbs and aromatics. And so we have a wonderful tea we call Peruvian evening tea that's really a perfect digestive. That's a complement of a good meal.
Well, we have had a wonderful, wonderful lunch. And listeners, we're coming back next week for dinner, and we'll have even more splendid things. And we'll report what we had for dinner.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, tell us where we are and also give us your website.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Andina is located in what we call the Pearl District in Portland. Recently, it becomes the place for foodies to come to try different food. So you will see around us many different good restaurants, each of them portraying the best of their food. And we are so blessed to be part of them. And that's, we are located in Gleason. The number is 1314. I hope somebody's listened to this address. They can visit us. We are, we honor each of our guests the way, the same way that Peruvians honor guests.
You and will your see. Website is?
And our website is andinarestaurant.com.
Well, listeners, this is a highlight that we almost didn't even anticipate until very recently, and we loved it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doris.
Thank you very much, and to you, Peter, and I hope you will enjoy a good dinner. I will be flying to Peru, but I will think about you, and before that, I'm planning to give you all the advice to have a pleasant and fruitful trip in Peru.
Thank you.
Thanks to both, and thank you so much.
It makes you want to go to Peru, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, that's what we're doing.
So guess what? On the menu, of course, is going to do that. We were going to do that anyway. We're just even more sure that we made a great choice.
And I must say that the food is so good. We had lunch, we had dinner, and then I actually took leftovers back to the hotel since we had a refrigerator and had leftovers from Andina for breakfast the next morning as well.
Oh, there you go. Well, this is just a testimony to your eating habits. Anyway, it's now time for us to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're, of course, still in Portland, Oregon, and another ethnic choice. And there are several Indian restaurants in the area.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't even know you're still in Portland at this the East India Company.
Well, the interesting thing is that there are several were recommended to us. The East India Company was the one that people seemed to know least about. But after this interview, you'll know more about it, and you'll want to go, because it's a really fine Indian dining experience transported to a very interesting part of the southwestern corner of downtown Portland.
Very sophisticated.
As you learn in the next few minutes.
Pradeep Chandrana, did I get that right now, Pradeep?
Yes, you got it right.
Just barely. At East India Company, tell us about East India Company Grill and Bar in Portland, Oregon.
Well, East India Company started in December 2007, and the owner of the restaurant, Prakash Reddy, I used to work for Prakash and his father in Japan in the 80s. I worked with them for 15 years. And then I moved to the East Coast in U.S., and Prakash moved here in Portland, Oregon, and he was very keen that I come back and join them, and we start a restaurant in Portland, Oregon, because we felt that Portland, Oregon does not have a high-end, good food Indian restaurant.
Well, I must say this restaurant is quite beautiful. It's very contemporary.
And thank you very much. Thank
the
you.
The space is
we
great.
We try.
Now, I have a quick correction to make, because the East India Company was founded in something like 1720.
Right. Now, East India
So you took over the name?
We just took the name, East India Company. Now, East India Company has a little history. They were they started running a trading company in the early 70s, 1700s, late 1700s in India. And then eventually they became part of the British governance in India, and so it has a lot of controversy too about the name. But the reason why we decided to call East India Company as the name of our restaurant is because East India Company was the first company or first trading company which brought Indian spices to the world.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So the good side about East India Company is what we saw, that they brought in spices to the world and introduced Indian culture through the Indian spices. So we want to introduce the Indian culture through Indian food.
Now, you have a lot of different things going on with your menu here. You have a lot of different opportunities for lunch, for early bird dinners. Tell us about some of those specials.
Yes, most Indian restaurants, if you see across the board in the United States, they have lunch buffets.
Yeah,
which are
I hate them with a passion.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody I met,
everybody sitting under those lights is awful.
Absolutely, everybody I meet, they say I hate them. At the same time, nobody wants to change. So very few.
They're always cheap.
They're inexpensive. A lot of food. So I guess that has an attraction towards getting people. On the other hand, I have never run a restaurant with buffets, so I don't personally believe in bringing food, bringing the guest to the food. I would rather bring the food to the guest.
Right.
So we have prefix lunches, reasonable price. I wouldn't say expensive or inexpensive. It's reasonable price. I have a $12.95 lunch, which is so reasonable that everybody, all the guests who have that lunch, they're totally impressed with the type of food that I bring in. And I bring in the appetizer first, then the barbecue, and then the curry, so people can spread their meal period. They can have a conversation. They can have some business meeting. They don't have to get up and keep going and filling up their plates. So that's the idea of bringing three different prefix lunches.
Well, there's how do I say this? We already talked about this contemporary feel in this restaurant. You go through this narrow bar, and then it opens up in this great, broad, high-ceiling space. There's a touch of class to every single detail, even the napkin ring.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So this is probably very important to you.
Very important. We detailed out everything before we started the restaurant, what kind of food we are going to serve, what kind of plates we are going to bring in, how we are going to present our food. All Indian restaurants serve the curry and the rice. We bring our rice plated in a pyramid shape and bring the curry on the side. We also serve a small vegetable of the day. So the whole presentation of all my entrees is amazing. I have a very nice choice of tandoori dishes.
Yeah, I like tandoori.
And all my barbecues, all the tandoori dishes have entrees have a different marinade. My lamb chops has a different marinade than my chicken tikkas, and my fish, grilled fish, has completely different marinade. So I use the unique ability of our tandoor oven, which is a vertical oven and which is popular all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, if I had my choice in the kitchen, I would have a tandoori oven at home.
Absolutely, and that's increasing. We have some friends here who all the time want to put up a small tandoor in their backyard or small tandoor in their house because it is so amazing to cook in the tandoor. The whole cooking process is so good. The marinades properly done, the meats taste amazing with tandoor.
Yeah, and the breads.
In fact, I met a chef here who is a chef of a hotel, and he made his own tandoor just about 3-4 months ago. And he sent me all the pictures. He actually brought a container and bought an oven, and he converted it into a tandoor oven. You know?
Yeah, I know lots of chefs who really swear by them. Now, it's very, I was going to say, is this, how authentic is this menu that you have? But what is authentic? It depends where you are in India. Every time you cross a border or change from valley to hill.
Absolutely.
So what parts of India are represented on this menu?
Well, our menu is predominantly North Indian, and it is authentic North Indian. If you walk into a good restaurant, high-end restaurant in Delhi or a high-end restaurant in Bombay, Mumbai, as it's called now, you will have the same taste of the food. On the other hand, I have some appetizers which are very popular on the sidewalks of India.
Street food.
Street food. And I just changed the presentation and brought the same taste of the street food. So if anybody walks into the street of Delhi and orders the appetizer that I have on the menu, it tastes exactly the same. accept that my presentation is completely changed, and it's very modern and it's contemporary. Yeah. You know.
Now, it's a very extensive menu. How are we going to figure out what to eat tonight? What are some things you would recommend?
Well, I would recommend a cold appetizer.
Like?
It's called papri chaat. It's, again, a street food, garbanzo beans, whole wheat puris, small puris, crispy puris, and with tamarind date chutney, with a mint chutney and a touch of yogurt. It's nicely spiced. I also recommend barbecued mushrooms. I grilled my mushrooms with a 5-green marinade. I use 5 different greens to marinate my mushrooms.
I've never had that. That's
and I can guarantee nobody ever has put it on their menu in Indian restaurants. And it's amazing. People come from all the way. A lot of people come and they just want to eat my mushrooms.
Well, you're the one that knows the food.
Absolutely.
You're the culinary director here, so you know
absolutely.
The food. So what else now?
I also recommend grilled halibut that we do. That is also, we do it in our tandoor oven. And it's excellent. We call it machli ka tikka. And it's marinated with 5 or 6 different spices. And I recommend the famous butter chicken.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about that. I saw it on the menu. But
yeah, it's very popular all over the country, even in India. The butter chicken, we marinate the whole chicken and cook it in the tandoor, and then debone the chicken and cook it in a butter tomato gravy.
No calories in that one.
Well, here is the difference between my restaurant and other restaurants. My food is less greasy, less oily. You won't see oil on my food. And though we call it butter chicken, we use butter to cook it. The quantity of butter used is very minimal.
Is it butter or is it ghee? Or?
No, it's butter, clarified butter.
Well, I mean, there's a lot for us to...
Absolutely, and we also recommend another lamb dish.
I love lamb.
Yeah, it's pot-roasted lamb with brown caramelized onions, and we cook it for several hours, and the lamb just melts in your mouth. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Now, what do you drink with all this?
Well, alcoholic and non-alcoholic, there are two issues here. We have a lot of guests who are non-alcoholic.
That's lassi.
And they try it lassi, yeah. We have a sweet lassi, we have a salted lassi, and we also have the famous mango lassi, which is the most popular lassi we have. We also have, in this restaurant, we also have some unique Indian alcoholic cocktails.
Which are completely unique.
It's very difficult. Yesterday we had a guest and he said, I've never seen it in any Indian restaurant anywhere in the United States. So if you like, we have some very unique cocktails too.
There's plenty to enjoy here. How about, did we say where we are?
Yes, we are located on 11th Avenue, Southwest 11th Avenue. The address is 821 Southwest 11th Avenue. Between Yamhill and Taylor.
And your web address?
And we are right behind the public library also.
Okay. That's a good
and
name.
Our web address is www.eastindiacopdx.com. One
PDX.
Word.
I just learned what that is.
Yes.
I know.
East India Co. PDX is one word.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward, Pradeep, to a wonderful meal, and thank you for taking the time, because you're getting very busy here already.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming over and visiting my restaurant, and I look forward to entertaining you and make sure that you enjoy my dinner.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
No, the baby was not part of the interview. It was just part of stages off, I guess, whatever you call it. But
I mean, whole families were in there. Everybody was there. Young dates. It was really cool.
It was a great time. And
the cocktails are mad, aren't they?
the cocktails are mad. They're not as mad as the cocktails at Andina, where Anne invented a new cocktail. And we promptly decided it was a cocktail we would never try again.
Now, I actually asked the server, please don't let anybody else order this. What I did was I took the cane sugar out of it the cane sugar. Otherwise, well, it was like drinking lime juice.
Well, you took the triple sec and the cane sugar out of a margarita. So it was a margaritaless margarita. Don't ever have one of those, listeners, because it tastes like, hey, it'll certainly make you pucker and it won't make you very happy. But that's not a good way to conclude a program. What we should do is conclude this program by saying there's more excitement about the Portland dining scene coming up in the next several weeks, so we hope you look forward to that.
And next time we should outline this whole program because people might want to do this next year.
Yeah, we'll certainly do that. We just couldn't fit it all into one program. In fact, we're already running over time as it is. So I think it's time to say until the same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.